Virtual CISO Moment is brought to you by vCISO Services, a leading provider of quality and experienced virtual chief information security officers for small and mid-sized businesses. Check them out at vcisoservices.com. Hi, I'm Greg Schaefer, and welcome to the Virtual CISO Moment Cybersecurity Wrap-Up for Friday, March 3rd, 2023. It's been a long week, but we made it to Friday. Starting off, you probably heard about this, been all over. Biden National Cybersecurity Strategy seeks to hold software firms liable for insecurity. Markets have imposed inadequate costs on companies that build vulnerable technology. This according to an article in the Wall Street Journal. The Biden administration said that it would pursue laws to establish liability for software companies that sell technology that lacks cybersecurity protections, concluding that market forces alone are just not sufficient to guard consumers and the nation. We have certainly seen that sometimes it takes regulation to get businesses to understand that they need to enhance their cybersecurity. Now, going on with that, free markets and a reliance on voluntary security frameworks have imposed inadequate costs on companies that offer insecure products or services, according to a national cybersecurity strategy release that was released yesterday. It says that the administration would work with Congress and the private sector to create liability for software vendors, sketching out in broad terms what such legislation would entail. So a quote from the 35-page strategy, "We must begin to shift the liability onto those entities that fail to take reasonable precautions to secure their software while recognizing that even the most advanced software security programs can't prevent all vulnerabilities." Interagency product that was this 35 page, it was written by the Office of the National Cyber Director, which is part of the Executive Office of the President. Strategy also advocates developing a more expansive framework of cybersecurity regulations to protect the nation's critical infrastructure. This includes energy operators, hospitals, and banks, among others. On a related note from Reuters, the White House on Monday gave government agencies 30 days to ensure they do not have Chinese-owned app TikTok on federal devices and systems. In a bid to keep U.S. data safe, all federal agencies must eliminate TikTok from phones and systems and prohibit internet traffic from reaching the company. Office of Management and Budget Director Shalanda Young told agencies in a guidance memorandum seen by Reuters. The ban that was ordered by Congress late last year follows similar actions from Canada, the EU, Taiwan, and more than half of the United States, U.S. states, that is. The device ban, while impacting just a tiny portion of the U.S. base for TikTok, adds fuel to calls for an outright ban on the video sharing app. National cybersecurity concerns, of course, about China, just national security concerns, surged in recent weeks after a Chinese balloon drifted over the United States. Now, ByteDance-owned TikTok has said the concerns are fueled by misinformation and has denied using the app to spy on Americans. The action does not affect the more than 100 million Americans who use TikTok on private or company-owned devices. TikTok did not immediately comment on the White House memo. A little commentary from myself with regards to TikTok. I had looked into it many years ago, found it not to be a very effective platform for what we try to do at our firm. And then, of course, later on, questions about its security became more evident. So as a cybersecurity firm, we, of course, do not use TikTok, and we encourage folks not to use it as well. Brian Krebs reports that hackers claim they breached T-Mobile more than 100 times in 2022. Three different cyber criminal groups claimed access to international networks at communications giant T-Mobile in more than 100 separate incidents throughout 2022, new data suggests. In each case, the goal of the attackers was the same: phish T-Mobile employees for access to internal company tools, and then convert that access into a cybercrime service that could be hired to divert any T-Mobile users' text messages and phone calls to another device. Now, according to Krebs, the conclusions above are based on an extensive analysis of Telegram chat logs from three distinct cybercrime groups or actors that have been identified by security researchers as particularly active in and effective at, quote, SIM swapping. And you should be aware of that. It involves temporarily seizing control over a target's mobile phone number. Countless websites and online services use SMS text messages for both password resets and multi-factor authentication. Still, this means that stealing someone's phone number can often then let cyber criminals hijack the target's entire digital life in short order, including access to any financial, email, and social media accounts tied to that phone number. And as a little commentary on the side there, that's one of the reasons why we recommend migrating away from SMS as a multi-factor authentication factor. All three SIM swapping entities that were tracked for this story remain active in 2023, and they all conduct business in open channels on the instant messaging platform Telegram, which Krebs on Security mentioned. Krebs on Security is not naming those channels or groups here because they will simply migrate to more private servers if exposed publicly. And for now, those servers remain a useful source of intelligence about their activities. Well, I think that if Brian Krebs already just said that they know that there's three channels out there, maybe he didn't say three channels, so maybe there's multiple. Anyway, he certainly doesn't want to lose an intel channel, if you will. ARS Technia says already smarting from a breach that stole customer vaults, somewhat related. LastPass has more bad news. LastPass says employee's home computer was hacked and corporate vault was taken. So apparently LastPass on this past Monday said that the same attacker hacked an employee's home computer and obtained a decrypted vault available to only a handful of company developers, this enhancing all of the bad news that has happened recently for LastPass. Now, although on an initial intrusion, according to the article, into LastPass ended on August 12th, officials with the company said the threat actor was, quote, actively engaged in a new series of reconnaissance, enumeration, and exfiltration activity from August 12th to August 26th. In that process, the unknown threat actor was able to steal valid credentials from a senior DevOps engineer and access the contents of LastPass Data Vault. Among other things, the vault gave access to a shared cloud storage environment that contained the encryption keys for customer vault step backups stored in Amazon S3 buckets. A quote here from LastPass officials, this was accomplished by targeting the DevOps engineer's home computer and exploiting a vulnerable third-party media software package, which enabled remote code execution capability and allowed the threat actor to implement keylogger malware. One question that I would ask immediately is the developer supposed to have the third-party media software package on their machine? The threat actor was able to capture the employee's master password as it was entered after the employee authenticated with multi-factor authentication and gained access to the DevOps engineer's LastPass corporate vault. The hacked engineer was only one of only four LastPass employees with access to this corporate vault. And once in possession of that vault, the threat actor exploited the entries. And this included the AWS S3 LastPass production backups, other cloud-based software, or rather storage resources, and some related critical database backups. Now, the update comes after 2 months after LastPass issued a previous bombshell update that for the first time, contrary to previous assertions, the attackers had obtained customer vault data containing both encrypted and plain text data. Now, here's something that's a little bit personal for me. You may or may not have encountered it, or you may be in the process of encountering it and just haven't quite realized it. So yesterday, I came into work, sat down at the office, fired up my machine like I usually do, and went into my calendar, and the calendar kept crashing. Now, I have been using Windows Calendar as my primary calendar for a variety of reasons, which I won't get into right here, but had generally not had any issues with it until yesterday. No matter what I did, could not get the calendar app to come up. Windows Mail came up fine. Calendar, no. Well, apparently, I'm not alone. The app keeps crashing or not opening after the latest update, and there is a fix in the works. This, according to Karanjot Sidhu at pionikabeb.com. The link is in the show notes. I apologize for my mispronunciation, if in fact it was mispronounced. According to reports, the Windows Calendar app's users say that it keeps crashing, making it impossible for them to use it. And then the article or the blog post has links to a few examples of folks saying that the affected users, myself included, claim that the moment they click on the calendar app, it begins to load before closing abruptly. When users attempt to go to the calendar after the mail has opened, the app opens briefly before crashing. Now, according to the post, here's the details. Microsoft recently began releasing the V16005.14326.21344.0 update. I wonder what the code is there for all those numbers, which some Windows users claim appears to have broken the calendar app. Troubleshooting methods like restarting the PC, I can attest to that. Updating Windows and also uninstalling and reinstalling the calendar app did not seem to work. I did not go as far as the latter because I had come to the point where realizing that something was wrong. But luckily, according to the article, a moderator has said, I guess a Microsoft moderator has said, that the team is aware of the problem with the Windows calendar app crashing and that a fix is in the works. However, there is no time frame for that fix. So use other calendar items, I guess, to be able to see where you're at during the day. And yes, I do have another calendar item that app that I am also using, so I'm not totally lost. Now, one thing I wanted to mention on Wednesday's live podcast, if you remember, if you listened to it live or post live when it was released on the podcast platforms, that was my 1 year anniversary of doing the interview formats that drop every Tuesday for the most part, which sometimes then I do specials on Wednesdays. And this was with Caroline McCaffrey. She is the founder of ClearOps and the host of the VCSO Chronicles. During that conversation, we discussed the need for VCSOs to be accurate when filling out vendor questionnaires, as there could be liability involved for answering incorrectly. Well, listener Denny Wan, or Wan rather, reached out to me after to note that the recent case of Travelers versus International Control Services, or ICS, is a timely reminder of the potentially catastrophic consequences of such oversights, leading to the denial of legitimate cyber claims and termination of the cyber policy. The court filing claimed that, quote, policy application signed by its CEO and a person responsible for the applicant network's network and information security, and that, as Denny says, sounds like a VCSO. I would agree to an extent. Generally speaking, a virtual CISO is not an officer of the company, and they actually report to somebody in the company who is responsible for network and information security, but it does not remove the fact that there could be liability there without a doubt. This is one of the reasons why I stress that businesses must vet their VCISO. There are too many VCISOs in name only. You can call it VCISO-ENO, I guess. A business needs a qualified virtual CISO that helps the business reduce information security risk, not enhance it. And I keep on saying, and I wish I could remember the guest that said this, but I always ask on the interview podcast, what do you think is the most one of the largest risks in information security to small and mid-sized businesses? And this respondent was bad advice. And this is a prime example. So the link to that article, it's actually from August of last year, but it's still relevant. That is also in the show notes. And thanks, Denny. Appreciate the most excellent input. Finally, I've got today's lists, and this is from bankinfosecurity.com, the 10 belt-tightening tips for CISOs to weather a downturn in this year. I'm assuming it's the downturn in 2023, meaning economic downturn. So Bank Info Security, by the way, is a good reference as well. I will sometimes draw articles from there to talk about. But this is four security officers share strategies for managing budgets and doing more with less. Let's see where we got the list here. So the outlook for the economy includes room for optimism, despite the economists who months have prognosticated a downturn. And they're saying employment is strong in several sectors. So far, spending on cybersecurity has not been a major target of corporate cutbacks. But still, ISMG, which is, I believe, the parent company of bankinfosecurity.com, asked four chief security officers in a range of industries. Canon Europe, I guess it's Canon copiers and printers and cameras, maybe. Southern Methodist University, Finergo, and SR Oil, how they would do more with less. And these are candid conversations. From these candid conversations, we have the following 10. It doesn't say if it's in any order. Number one, look for ways to consolidate security tools. Yes, we've talked about this before on the podcast. You got tool sprawl. You don't have a great inventory, perhaps, of all the tools you have. Some tools might be duplicating services. Some tools might be leaving a gap. And definitely should do a gap analysis on your tools. And if you can consolidate them, then that can definitely save some money. So as Quentin Taylor says, CISO or senior director at Canon of Information Security, that smaller shops with a Microsoft E5 license can deploy a host of security products for little additional cost. Number two, be prepared for vulnerabilities in IT operations. That's pretty much standard, I think, that you should always be looking for that. But where they're going here with this is attrition and hiring freezes, for example, could affect patching programs, adding that as the patching backlog grows, the business risks exposure to more vulnerabilities. Number three, renegotiate contracts with your managed service providers. That may or may not work. Certainly, they want to keep your business, so you might be able to negotiate a lower price or change scope and therefore have a lower price. Because their incentive is that they want to keep definitely the customer going. Number four, take a hard look at your supply chain partners. You're only as secure as your weakest partner, which may be a supply chain partner. This is interesting. In addition to vetting suppliers for their cybersecurity practices, which of course everybody should be doing, the recommendation here is take the extra step of educating them and in helping them to strengthen their programs. I think that that's a good idea. If you can help your partners in any way, shape, or form strengthen their security programs, that's awesome. Number five, double down on cyber awareness training. Totally support that. And I'm one of those that believes that training is an essential part of an overall holistic strategy for information security, posture, risk reduction, not just to check the box. Focus on incident response and resiliency. If you're not doing a tabletop exercise at least once a year, maybe more, you're really missing out, because you need to not only have a good incident response and business continuity disaster recovery plans in place, but you need to be able to test them to be able to find gaps. The only way that sometimes you can find gaps is if you actually run through it, and you'd rather run through it in a controlled environment as opposed to when something bad happens. Number seven, beef up your email defenses. DMARC would be a good thing to add. DKIM and SPF, you should probably have in place as well too, but definitely look into that. Number eight, introduce more automation of security processes. We've been going in that direction for a while. And now that we have more input with artificial intelligence, certainly that can help in a variety of areas. Number nine, look for projects that will reduce cyber insurance costs. I guess if you can show your insurer that you have increased your posture, it should result in potentially a lower premium. And you probably want to check that out with your insurer. And then number 10, train and hire security specialists from within. This is such a simple thing, but it's so effective. If you bring someone who starts out in IT and then bring them along, they already know your business. They already know your data flows. They already know the culture, but you slowly bring them along in information security. That not only is more cost effective from the fact that you're not having to lay out the large dollars initially to bring someone in, but you can incrementally bring up their salary as they learn. Plus, you don't have to go through all of the expense of recruiting, paying for a recruiter, for example. That can be very expensive. And then the onboarding, and just a new employee starting in any organization, that's a significant cost in time and productivity and money. And that's it for this week. I did want to close by saying again how much I appreciate all your support, particularly with the live stream, and that was a bit of a reach for me to do that. Doing myself live like this is one thing. That was a growth beyond my comfort zone, if you will. But doing the interview live was certainly something that was way beyond my comfort zone. a lot of this has been, and I've appreciated the support over time. We're approaching now 20,000 plays on all the podcast platforms alone, and this doesn't include the live streaming and YouTube, all this in 1 year since changing the format. And I do this out of love for the industry. I look forward every week to bringing stories of great people smarter than me, driving information security, and then these bi-weekly news updates, which hopefully they are helpful to you. I point our clients to this as well, too, as a measure of their information security awareness. And I may not report on them all. I try to give highlights. And I know I'm going to miss some, but just like information security layered strategy, your threat intel and threat awareness strategy, both whether you're a security practitioner or you're a SMB leader, a CEO, CFO, what have you, you should have a varied resources for your information security awareness. And I hope that you continue to consider the Virtual CISO Moment as one of those channels for you. And remember, for those of you that have security certifications, you can also use podcast listenings for CPEs to earn them. I personally, from a long time back, used to do that for many years by listening to Security Now with Steve Gibson. I don't get a chance to listen to Mr. Gibson as much as I'd like to anymore, certainly because of the things that I do now, but that's an awesome, fabulous podcast. If you've never heard of it, that's probably my favorite out there. One last thing. ISC Squared Security Congress will be in Nashville in October of this year, late October. If you're planning to go, let me know and we'll connect. I certainly hope to be there. And that's it for today. Looking forward to see you on Monday. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. And until then, of course, and as always, stay secure.